Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Thursday's expected release of the last of the JFK files on the Kennedy assassination, following a 1992 order from Congress to the National Archives to release the documents 25 years later. Along with MLK and RFK, the JFK assassination has long been the subject of a cottage industry of conspiracy theories, and now with a conspiracy theorist in the Oval Office who claimed Ted Cruz's father was seen with Lee Harvey Oswald shortly before Kennedy's death, we have Trump tweeting out on Saturday that, quote, "I will be allowing, as president, the long-blocked and classified JFK files to be opened." Philip Sheehan, the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Commission, and a former reporter with the New York Times for 20 years, joins us to discuss his latest book, A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination, and his article at Politico, The JFK Document Dump Could Be a Fiasco. We'll examine whether Thursday's release will satisfy conspiracy theorists and whether there will be further redactions before the release of the last of the classified documents. And then we will speak with Charlie Sykes, the longtime host of the number one conservative talk radio show in Wisconsin, who is now a regular contributor to MSNBC. He joins us to discuss his new book just out, How the Right Lost Its Mind, and the paradoxical place the Republican Party is now in, with control of all branches of government and the judiciary, but with all that power, they can't seem to get anything done and are becoming increasingly unpopular. We will look into why Republicans have abandoned facts in the Trump era, why they can't govern, and when will traditional Republicans fight back in Steve Bannon's, quote, season of war against the GOP. Then finally, we will examine how voter suppression in Wisconsin may well have been the deciding factor in Trump's narrow win of 23,000 votes in that key swing state. Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, joins us to discuss his article at Mother Jones, Rigged, How Voter Suppression Threw Wisconsin to Trump. We will look into the key role in enabling voter suppression that the judiciary played, and now that Trump is stacking the federal courts with reactionary judges, how Wisconsin's, quote, success in voter suppression will be expanded nationwide. And joining us now is Philip Sheehan, the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter at the New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for the New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department, and as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination, and he has an article at Politico, The JFK Document Dump Could Be a Fiasco. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Sheehan.
Ian, thank you.
Well, thank you, Phil. And why do you think this document dump on Thursday, assuming it happens, could be a fiasco?
Well, it's going to be a logistical mess because we're talking about tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of documents being released all at once. And I think people are going to rush to judgment about what's in there, when in fact it may take months, if not years, to really sort it all out. It's also going to be a potential disaster because I think there is still the strong possibility, despite what the president said in his tweet over the weekend, that some documents are going to be withheld, which is simply going to breed more conspiracy theories.
And the ones that are likely to be withheld, from what we're told, are CIA documents involving CIA assets in Mexico, particularly, I imagine, Mexican intelligence, and the extent to which the CIA had the Cuban and the Russian embassy covered or under constant surveillance, and what that surveillance picked up in terms of Oswald's visit to Mexico City, just a few weeks before Kennedy was killed.
Right. You know, to my mind, there's always been this whole mysterious chapter of the Kennedy assassination drama, which involves a fact that I think most Americans are unaware of, even a lot of historians seem to be largely unaware of, which is that 6 weeks before the assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald turns up in Mexico City where we know from previously declassified files he's dealing with Cuban spies and Russian spies and other people who at the height of the Cold War in 1963 might have wanted to see John Kennedy dead. And we know something else from these declassified files, the ones we've already got. The CIA was watching Oswald. They had him under close surveillance in Mexico City. And the question becomes for me, what else did the CIA know in real time several weeks before the assassination about the threat that Lee Harvey Oswald might pose? There's another FBI document suggesting that Oswald was talking openly in Mexico City about killing Kennedy. And the question becomes, why didn't our law enforcement and intelligence agencies act on the information they had before the assassination? Because if they had, President Kennedy might have survived his trip to Dallas.
Well, if you pull back a little bit in the sweep of history throughout the Cold War, how many people were Marine guards on the U-2 plane, the top secret CIA program, at the base that they flew out of in Japan? They also flew out of a base in northern Pakistan. It was the top secret program of the CIA, the U-2. Oswald was a guard. A Marine guard guarding the U-2. Then, for reasons I'm not sure about the history, the details, but he shows up in Russia as a, you know, embracing communism and as a defector from the U.S. Marines. Then he gets married off to a Russian by the KGB. And then he comes back to the United States and he ends up killing the president of the United States. There are not many people with that kind of profile during the Cold War. So it's little wonder. I mean, I would expect both the FBI and the CIA to be watching this guy.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't blame anybody for having conspiracy theories involving Lee Harvey Oswald, because this is a guy who, whatever he was, lived his life like a secret agent, like he was working for somebody else. And you have to remember, the assassination occurs when Oswald is 24. He'd accomplished all that prior to the assassination, been all around the world. Again, he's a guy who lived his life as if he was operating in a world of cloak and dagger. And again, I don't blame anybody for the conspiracy theories that center on whether or not Oswald was acting on somebody's behest.
Well, isn't there another thread, though, to these conspiracy theories? And that goes back to one of the Mandarins, one of the founders of the CIA, Fitzpatrick, who was in the station chief in Paris. Colonel Cabela from Cuba said he wanted to defect, said he was close to Castro. The CIA gave him all kinds of assassination tools, most of which are in a museum in Havana to this day. And apparently Desmond Fitzgerald kept asking Colonel Cabela, where are these orders coming from to kill Castro? And eventually he said from the very top, meaning the president. Then Cabela goes back to Havana and gives Castro all of the assassination tools that the CIA had given him. And they both have a good laugh. But a lot of people think that Castro famously came to the conclusion, well, this guy's trying to kill me. I better get the jump on him.
Well, and that's a logical theory about what happened here. I will tell you that as somebody who's been studying this for several years now, I know of no credible evidence to suggest that Fidel Castro personally ordered this assassination. But there were people Oswald encountered during this strange trip in Mexico City who may have felt they were acting in Castro's best interests and thought that President Kennedy had to die before Kennedy could kill Castro. And there were several hundred documents that were released over the summer from within the CIA. And they do offer a fascinating theory, apparently a theory discussed at the CIA about what had motivated Oswald, that he had read a particular newspaper article in September 1963. It was an Associated Press article, an interview with Fidel Castro, in which Castro said he knew that the Kennedy administration was trying to kill him. The argument being that Oswald read that argument, became enraged on Castro's behalf, and set out to kill Kennedy before Kennedy could kill Castro. And, of course, what we now know pretty authoritatively is that, indeed, President Kennedy was trying to kill Castro for a long time.
And again, I'm speaking with Philip Sheehan, the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And he has an article at Politico, The JFK Document Dump Could Be a Fiasco. Now, I brought up the Kennedy, the Castro angle, because for two reasons, Phil. One is that that is what the president who succeeded JFK, Lyndon Baines Johnson, always believed to his deathbed, I believe, that he believed that Castro was behind Kennedy's killing somewhere or other. And also, my understanding about how the intelligence agent world works is that the main people they keep secret from are their own people, either to cover up their incompetence or to cover up the fact that if, for example, the CIA were forced to release, assuming it's true, the information that Castro ordered the killing of Kennedy in order to prevent Kennedy from killing him, then the American people would demand something get done and nothing could be done because of what the deal that was made after the Cuba crisis. So that's at least my theory, that governments more often than not keep secrets from their own people because their people would demand they do something when in fact they can't.
Absolutely. And I think the record shows that immediately after the assassination, the new president, President Johnson, was determined to get investigations of the assassination over with just as quickly as he could to find that, Oswald was this lone wolf. There was no conspiracy, because if there was any evidence to the contrary, Johnson might have felt compelled to act. You know, we know he said that he was worried that he'd have to begin a nuclear war if it was found that there was any indication at all that the Cubans or the Soviets were involved. He didn't want that to be the finding. He wanted the finding to be that this dismal young misfit named Lee Harvey Oswald did it and did it alone, even though, as you're right, as we now know at the end of his life, Johnson was pretty firmly committed to the idea that Castro had some involvement in Kennedy's assassination.
Well, I think it's reasonable to without being a conspiracy theorist, it's reasonable to come to the conclusion that the Warren Commission was rigged, because the guy that really ran it from behind the scenes was Alan Dulles, the former head of the CIA, who Kennedy fired over the Bay of Pigs. And believe it or not, Alan Dulles still had, even though he was fired from the CIA, he had built a little kind of a house or a summer house for himself at the farm, the CIA training ground in Virginia. And he was there, I believe, at the farm when the assassination took place. And
well, I know there's a recent book about Dulles that makes that argument.
Right.
I'll tell you, I hear this argument that Dulles was the secret mastermind of the Warren Commission and the cover-up after the assassination. I'll tell you, I've talked to a lot of the Warren Commission staff lawyers who are around at the time, and they will tell you that Dulles couldn't have been that he was virtually senile at that point.
Mm-hmm.
He was puttering around in slippers in the commission's offices because of his terrible gout, that he would fall asleep at commission meetings. It seems hard to believe that man at that point in his career could be the mastermind. I will tell you, though, there are certainly others that were manipulating the Warren Commission and hiding information from it, and most important among them is a man named James Jesus Angleton, who was the CIA's counterintelligence director at the time, the chief spy hunter. And it certainly is very clear he controlled the evidence that reached the Warren Commission, and he was determined to hide a lot of information from the Warren Commission that would suggest the CIA had bungled intelligence before the assassination that could have saved Kennedy's life.
Well, I've had a number of conversations with William Colby, the former head of the CIA, who eventually fired James Jesus Angleton. And Angleton was a complete paranoid and nutcase, wasn't he? He almost single-handedly destroyed the CIA's counterintelligence capabilities, and believed all kinds of whack jobs coming out of the Soviet Union, and at the same time imprisoned really valuable agents that escaped the Soviet Union.
Oh, absolutely. Angleton, I know, is the focus of a biography that's being published just next week.
Mm-hmm.
That man probably did more damage to the CIA international security than anybody else in the history of the CIA. And he was a paranoid, alcoholic, duplicitous figure who I say did terrible damage to this country.
Well, let's turn to the where there's real grist for the mill in terms of conspiracy, and that is the role of Ruby. In other words, I did talk to a lot of senior CIA people that were there at the time, and they said when Oswald was killed, they just threw up their arms in despair. There's no way we're going to find out what happened here. So, what's your understanding? Was Ruby working for somebody, or is it just some grandstander?
Well, it certainly made sense that after Ruby killed Oswald, you know, 2 days after the president himself had been killed, that people would think that Ruby had been dispatched to kill Oswald. And there was certainly reason to believe that, because Ruby did indeed have some low-level ties to organized crime and to the Italian-American mob families. But I'll tell you, though, as somebody who spent years of my life looking at some of this evidence, Ruby, like Oswald, was a total misfit. Delusional, and a blabbermouth to boot. And the idea that anybody in organized crime or anywhere else would pick that man, Jack Ruby, to carry out what would have been the other crime of the century, I just find it almost impossible to believe. And Ruby, who appeared to be seriously mentally ill, was found by both the government and his own defense lawyers to be seriously mentally ill after the assassination. When he was questioned about this, he insisted over and over and over again he did it alone. There had been no conspiracy. He did it to protect Jacqueline Kennedy from having to return to Dallas to testify at Oswald's trial.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Phil Sheehan, clearly the 1992 directive from the Congress to the National Archives to release these last of these classified documents on the assassination 25 years later, which is this coming Thursday. Apparently, Oliver Stone's movie about JFK at the time had some influence, but all of the conspiracy theories, including Oliver Stone's conspiracy theories, seem to be going down all kinds of rabbit holes about other assassins. It's pretty clear, and it seems always to have been pretty clear, that actually Lee Harvey Oswald did it. I mean, that's not the issue, is it? It's whether or not somebody encouraged him or helped him or directed him to do it. And two, as we just discussed, you know, how come he was killed? Well, you've answered that. But what about that other question? Is that really why there's such a cottage industry in conspiracy theories, that people simply can't get their head around the idea that some nutcase can actually kill a beloved American president?
Oh, I think that's exactly it. You know, I think the conspiracy theories are natural in many ways, because there's this essential logical disconnect, and I think there was certainly in November 1963. You know, how could the most powerful man in the world be brought down by this 24-year-old misfit carrying a $21 mail order rifle? That just didn't make sense to people. It would make much more sense that this had been some grand conspiracy by gray-haired men in Washington or Moscow or Havana or someplace else. That's where we begin with the conspiracy theories. But I think the record now shows, the record that's been building all these years, is that there was a cover-up. There was a conspiracy, certainly, to hide the truth about what the government knew before the assassination to suggest that Oswald might be a threat. And, you know, there are several senior officials of both the CIA and the FBI who will acknowledge that if those agencies had just acted on the information in their own files on November 21st, 1963, the assassination the next day would not have taken place. It's very much like 9/11 to my mind in many ways, which is the government actually had a lot of information to predict about what was just about to happen, but bungled that intelligence and then tried to cover up afterwards.
Well, Philip Sheehan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Sheehan, who's the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. His latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. And he has an article at Politico, The JFK Document Dump Could Be a Fiasco. Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined by Charlie Sykes, who will be discussing his new book just out, How the Right Lost Its Mind.
Last week I had the strangest dream, where everything was exactly how it seemed, where there was never any mystery of who shot John F. Kennedy. It was just a man with something to prove. Slightly bored and severely confused, he steadied his rifle with his target in the center.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Sykes, who has written for The Wall Street Journal and Time.com, among others, and in 2016 was featured for his critiques of Donald Trump and conservative media in articles on the front pages of The New York Times, The New York Times Magazine, and NPR. A longtime host of the number one conservative talk radio show in Wisconsin, he resigned that position and is now a regular contributor to MSNBC. And his latest book just out is How the Right Lost Its Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charlie Sykes.
Thank you very much.
And Charlie, since you didn't hear the opening of the program, basically I said we're going to be talking to you about your new book, How the Right Lost His Mind, and the paradoxical place the Republican Party is now in, with control of all branches of government and the judiciary, but with all that power, they can't seem to get anything done and are becoming increasingly unpopular. We'll look into why Republicans have abandoned facts in the Trump era and why they can't govern, and when will traditional Republicans fight back in Steve Bannon's season of war against the GOP. So there's quite a menu there for you to choose from. Where do you want to start?
Well, it is interesting the way that this has been playing out in 2017. Nothing that Donald Trump has done should really come as a surprise to anyone that was paying attention to his campaign over the last several years, or actually to his career over the last several decades. Or it should not come as a surprise that Republicans are having a hard time governing. One of the arguments I make in the book is that the Republicans, and particularly the conservative movement, had created what I call a perpetual outrage machine, where they became very, very clear about what they were against and who they hated, but very much less clear about what they were for. And the lack of a coherent or effective governing philosophy, I think, reflects that.
But I can't figure out Stephen Bannon. I read the entire talk he gave to the Republicans here in California, in Anaheim, over the weekend. And, of course, as you know, the Republican Party is not in great shape here. But he's at times very intelligent, very aware of global events. He seems to have a pretty sophisticated take on the Chinese, but yet everything he's advocated, for example, getting rid of the TPP, which was a way to contain China, everything is counterintuitive. And the idea that somebody like Judge Roy Moore could advance anybody's agenda, I find very puzzling, let alone Chemtrails Kelly in Arizona.
Let's start with those two. A couple of weeks ago, I described Roy Moore's victory in the Republican primary in Alabama as an acid flashback for Republicans who remembered back in 2010 and 2012 when the party nominated unelectable candidates for U.S. Senate seats in Nevada, you know, Sharon Engel, or in Delaware, Christine, I am not a witch, O'Donnell. So there does seem to be this desire to bring back Crazy Town, without mincing any words. Steve Bannon is a fascinating character and plays a central role in the age of Trump. What he's doing right now, though, and I think maybe the explanation is that what he's doing right now is he's following through on all of those promises to burn it all down, tear it all down. His appeal is primarily negative. It is that perpetual outrage machine.
And I think what even Donald Trump might be realizing now is that they are unable to control all of the forces that they unleashed. So if Donald Trump is the face of what the Republican Party is now, Roy Moore really is the face of what the party is becoming, where it's becoming more extreme, a little bit more unhinged. And voters seem to be going for the, I would say, the fringiest characters on the ballot.
So when Steve Bannon praises Trump, is it a little bit disingenuous? After all, remember, he first supported Ted Cruz, and the biggest donor to Trump, the Mercers, basically have been funding Bannon, and they moved Bannon in to take over the campaign once Trump got the nomination, which he did without their help. And obviously, they were very clever. Let's face it. They were brilliant with digital, while Hillary was wasting all that money on old-fashioned TV advertising, etc. But I've never had the feeling that there's any real loyalty there. And I'd be more interested in what Mercer's motives are than what Steve Bannon's motives are.
Well, they're obviously connected, and you cannot talk about Bannon's effectiveness now without talking about the fact that he has the Mercer billions behind him. I mean, the Mercers pumped a ton of money into Breitbart.com and really made it the power that it was in the conservative media over the last year. Robert Mercer has been described as somebody who also would like to see basically burn it all down. He doesn't care if the federal government becomes shambolic because of his anti-government philosophy. But, you know, both of them, I think, see Donald Trump as a vessel to get what they want. There are a lot of people out there who regard Trump with adoration as the Orange God King cult of personality. I think they have a more cynical view that Donald Trump can be the instrument by which they push this their nationalist, nativist, populist agenda. So they will ride him for as long as they can. What I think is going to be interesting is that if they do find themselves breaking with Trump, where does the Republican base go? Does the Republican base follow Bannon and the Mercers, or is it going to stick with Donald Trump because he's their guy? I don't know that we've gotten a definitive answer to that yet.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Sykes, who has written for The Wall Street Journal and Time.com, among others, and in 2016 was featured for his critiques of Donald Trump and conservative media in articles on the front pages of The New York Times, The New York Times Magazine, and NPR. A longtime host of the number one conservative radio talk show in Wisconsin, he resigned that position and is now a regular contributor to MSNBC. And his latest book just out is How the Right Lost Its Mind. So just going back to this strange paradox of the Republicans controlling all branches of government, dominating the judiciary, yet not being able to get anything done and getting more unpopular. The only thing that stares out, though, in contrast to that, and that's an awful lot to digest on its own, is the absolute vacuous nature of the Democratic Party. It's almost as if there is no opposition in this country. I'm a Democrat, and all I get from them is requests for money. It just feels like I don't know where they are. You're a Republican. How do you see them?
I would not describe myself as a Republican. I'm a conservative, but not part of the conservative movement.
Right. You're a recovering Republican then.
Well, I do think that one of the stories of the last several years has been how the Democratic Party has been decimated nationally. I think the fact that the Democrats controlled the White House perhaps caused people to miss what was happening at the grassroots level. The number of legislatures lost, the number of congressional seats lost, the way in which this country, you know, had moved away from them, or another way to put it, the way the party had become disconnected with much of its own base. And that's something that I think that they're going to have to confront, because as shambolic as the Trump administration has been so far, and we could go through, you know, all the pratfalls, he could be reelected in 2020 if, in fact, the Democrats do not get their act together, do not figure out how to get those disaffected voters. I think a lot of Democrats simply think that being anti-Trump is going to be sufficient. And sometimes it is. Sometimes, I mean, maybe this administration will completely melt down. But I would also suggest that the Democrats are going to have to come up with some sort of a vision that's better than simply no. Although I've heard Democrats make the case, look, Republicans didn't come up with a positive agenda. They were basically the party of no, and look how that worked for them.
Well, it does seem, though, that there are structural problems that the Democrats have to face, and that is the concentration of people in urban areas. My understanding is that the Electoral College will probably come into play more and more in the way that it did in this last one, with Hillary Clinton getting 3 million more popular votes, but nevertheless Trump winning. And that by in 20 years or so, you could end up with a situation where the 60% of the Senate is elected by 40% of the country. So how do you, and gerrymandering, and we're going to do a segment after you, Charlie Sykes, with Ari Berman has just done a piece on how voter suppression in Wisconsin actually was a factor, if not the main factor. At least he makes that case. So there's a whole, it seems like the Republicans have been very, very successful on a whole kind of wider playing field with all kinds of tactics. But the fundamental demographic changes, how do you deal with that?
Well, that's a key question. Let me just address just one point that you made there, because of course I'm from Wisconsin,
sure,
and was surprised by the outcome of the election. And I will say at this point I'm very skeptical of the claims that vote suppression was the variable. I think more important than the voter ID bill was the fact that Hillary Clinton never came here, never bothered to ask for the vote. The undervote in Milwaukee County, I think, had a lot to do with the fact that voters who were enthusiastic about turning out for Barack Obama, the nation's first African-American president, were underwhelmed by turning out for a 70-year-old white woman who would not even come to the state. So I, at this point, am unpersuaded by that argument. But you ask about the demographics. Gerrymandering is a problem, but I would also caution people that it is not the magic bullet, because gerrymandering doesn't determine the Electoral College, obviously, also doesn't determine the number of governors that are elected or the U.S. Senate. Those still are, problems that Democrats are going to have to confront. But I also think that Republicans have a demographic nightmare coming when you think about the way they have alienated young people, women, minorities, and by minorities, I mean not just African-Americans, but Hispanics, Asian-Americans, all of those groups that I think are growing demographically. And I do wonder whether or not the California model might be on the horizon for Republicans. There was once a time, of course, as you know, when California was a quite competitive state. And, because of a variety of, I think, political misjudgments, they've turned California very much, and again, part of this is the demographics, turned it very much into a state dominated by the Democrats. I think demographics in the long term work against a Republican Party that is associated with Trumpism. Trumpism can seize one or two victories because of what you described, pick off a Michigan or pick off a Wisconsin. But long run, I don't see much future for a party that is this is exclusionary.
But when Steve Bannon says, as he did down in Michigan and also in California, to the Republican rank and file in the era of Trump, I guess that's a necessary caveat, that they, the GOP establishment, look down on you. They think you're a bunch of rubes. They have contempt for you. There is this kind of weird populism going on, and as you know, you just pointed out that you think in Wisconsin Hillary Clinton lost because she didn't talk to the white working class. Well,
to
African Americans in particular, yeah. In Milwaukee, yeah. where I think it was 45,000 fewer showed up than did in 2012, and that probably there alone because she lost by 23,000 votes.
Exactly.
So this is my sense is that. When you say maybe the Mercers just want this government to be totally shambolic, is there a more cynical explanation here in the sense that
It would be a brilliant coup on the part of the Republican Party to steal the working class base of the Democrats. And if the Democrats don't talk to their own base, except for Bernie Sanders, then they deserve to lose.
Well, in fact, that's what they did in 2016. The white working class has been trending toward the Republicans for a long time. And I think one of the shocks of 2016 was realizing, for Democrats to realize, the extent to which they had lost voters who had been in reliably Democratic households. I mean, you know, the folks who used to vote for Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey and even Barack Obama, many of them voted for Donald Trump. And I think in part it's because they were ignored by both political parties for a long time. When Donald Trump stood up and he said, you know, you are the forgotten Americans, but I will be your voice. That was really the key. That was very Bannon-esque of him to be able to say to folks, you're not registering. The Democrats are clearly not talking about you. They're moving on as if, you know, they're talking about you with the identity politics. The quote unquote Republican establishment had become a party representing corporate interest, corporatism. And the white working class was like, what? What are we, chopped liver? When's the last time anybody talked about our issues? It was very effective. But also keep in mind that Steve Bannon is a very effective and I think very cynical demagogue. And to convince people, particularly in the Trump base, that, well, you are always despised, they always look down on you, is an important rhetorical tool that he uses to make them feel like they're victims, to make them feel like they're outsiders, and to, you know, again, to fuel this sense that you are being betrayed by Republicans and Democrats, and that's why you ought to go along with Donald Trump. So there's a heavy dose of demagoguery mixed in with this populism.
So then, Charlie Sykes, on the other side, given that the Bannon strategy has been very successful with Trump to peel off the Democratic base into the Republican tent, is there a counter strategy that the Democrats could enact if they start to come up with anything? And that would be, because my sense is that because we have an unusual system in this country where our head of state is also our political leader, we don't have a queen, that there's a certain expectation in terms of our head of state that we expect a certain decorum and dignity, which we're certainly not getting from Donald Trump. Do you think it's possible to peel off some Republicans into a more centrist place, whether that's another party or whether the Democrats could steal the Republican center?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I certainly hope that they attempt that as opposed to lurching farther left and driving independents and center-right folks back into Donald Trump's arms. This question of the sense of decorum and just the sense of the character of the man ought to be a huge dividing line in American society, and polls suggest that it is. But you do wonder whether or not Donald Trump has redefined what is acceptable, that our culture has been coarsened to the point where, I mean, we've already elected a reality TV star who clearly, you know, lack any basic qualifications for the presidency. This is part of the celebrity culture. His crudity, his vulgarity, his deception was not considered disqualifying for 60-some million Americans or for the Republican Party. This is a man who bragged about sexually assaulting women, and yet they rallied around him, and they continue to support him. So you do wonder, what are the standards anymore? What will the voters do? But I certainly hope that there is that one of the reactions to the era of Trump might be a return to just a sense of decorum, may be too strong a word, but how about just fundamental decency, honesty, fact-based politics, belief in the rule of law, those sorts of things. Will there be a possible reaction? Remember, after Richard Nixon, you know, the country went with Jimmy Carter. After Jimmy Carter, it went with Ronald Reagan. You know, after George Bush, with Barack Obama. There tends to be a cycle in American politics where voters seem to go for the opposite of what they had before. The opposite of Donald Trump would be somebody who was coherent, was decent, who was honest, who treated others with respect, who would restore dignity and decorum to the office of the presidency. And that would be something that I think would be incredibly welcome, as opposed to I don't know, shifting further to the left and creating more of this binary choice where everyone on the right feels they have to support Trump.
But how do you restore a consensus about what is real and what is true in the country that's still the dominant power on the planet? And it's a frightening concept that we simply, as a nation, don't have any consensus about what is real and what is true. And one of the most disturbing statistics is that the Pew Research Center recently did a poll that found that Republicans expressing support for Vladimir Putin had doubled in just 2 years from 17% to 34%. And as you know, on MSNBC a lot, where you appear quite a lot, a lot of the commentators talk about the Russian investigation as though it's some form of wishful thinking that somehow it will be the magic bullet to get rid of Trump. And I'm not sure that it's wise to make that investment. I think the Democrats have got to invest in a strategy and a program as opposed to a hope that Robert Mueller will do the heavy lifting for them. But nevertheless, I'm absolutely astounded by why the Republicans make excuses for Putin, and also on the far left of the Democratic side, they also make excuses for Putin.
Oh, I agree with you absolutely. I find this among the most shocking developments, and I will say that I don't know what they're going to come up with, but I think that it is a hugely important investigation. It's one of the reasons why I agreed to join. Actually, I joined Rob Reiner in being on the advisory committee of his committee to investigate Russia, because you know he and I don't agree on everything, but we are both patriots. We both understand that if a foreign power has actually tried to hack our democracy, we need to confront that. We need to get to the bottom of that. This question about being a post-factual society and the post-truth politics is really a fundamental question. And I spent a lot of time in my book talking about the rise of the alternative reality media on the right, the attack on truth that we saw during 2016, and the way in which Trump and his allies are continuing that campaign. I mean, this war against the media is not just a war between Donald Trump, a politician, and CNN. It really is an attack on credibility itself. And it's a fundamental attack on the roots of our democracy when you have the central government, the president of the United States, using all of his power and authority to delegitimize so many independent sources of criticism or checks, whether it is the media or whether it's the judiciary or the intelligence agencies, any of those. And I think this poses a very real existential threat to some of the democratic norms that perhaps we had taken for granted.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Sykes, who has written for The Wall Street Journal and Time.com, among others. And in 2016, he was featured for his critiques of Donald Trump and conservative media in articles on the front page of The New York Times, The New York Times Magazine, and NPR. A longtime host of the number one conservative talk radio show in Wisconsin, he resigned that position and is now a regular contributor to MSNBC. And his latest book just out is How the Right Lost Its Mind. And this is a book that we're offering up in support of Background Briefing and KPFK at 818-985-5735 for a $125 donation. This brand new book by Charlie Sykes. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how voter suppression was the main reason Trump won in the key state of Wisconsin.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones, covering voting rights, and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And his latest book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And he has an article at Mother Jones, Rigged, How Voter Suppression Threw Wisconsin to Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Hey, Ian. Good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you, Ari. And your piece points out that Trump won Wisconsin by a little under 23,000 votes. And this was a state which ranked second in the nation in voter participation in 2008 and 2012, yet it saw its lowest turnout in 2016 since 2000, with half of the state's decline occurring in Milwaukee, where 41,000 fewer people voted than they did in 2016 and 2012. And, of course, Milwaukee has a very, very high percentage of, in fact, two-thirds of the state's African-Americans live in Milwaukee. And much of the work that you did was profiling people in Milwaukee who didn't vote, right?
Yes. So my story was about the impact of Wisconsin's voter ID law on the 2016 election. Wisconsin passed one of the strictest laws in the country that said you had to have a Wisconsin driver's license or ID to be able to vote. And a federal court found that 300,000 registered voters, which was 9% of the electorate, did not have these forms of ID when the law passed. And I found that throughout the 2016 election, there were huge problems, first with the implementation of the law, and then with the effect of the law. Basically, what happened is people showed up who had voted all their lives and were told they didn't pass the ballot. They did not have the right ID for one reason or another. And a much larger percentage of people just didn't show up at all because they knew their votes wouldn't count. And so there was a study by the University of Wisconsin that surveyed non-voters in Milwaukee and Madison, two of the most Democratic areas of the state, and they found that 1 in 10 non-voters cited the voter ID law as a reason why they didn't cast a ballot. So that was up to 23,000 voters in two counties that didn't vote because of this law. That was larger than Donald Trump's margin of victory in the state. If you extrapolate further, up to 45,000 people statewide, almost double Donald Trump's margin of victory. So this certainly contributed to Trump's win in Wisconsin. There's no doubt about it.
And the voter, one of the voters that you profiled, Andrea Anthony, 37-year-old African-American mother and grandmother, she had mislaid her driver's license and essentially was given 72 hours to get a new driver's license. She got a provisional ballot. She had to go to the DMV to get a new ID and then to the city clerk's office to confirm a vote within 72 hours of election day. And she had a job. And as I mentioned, she has kids and grandkids and simply couldn't get away from work and couldn't vote. And voting was incredibly important to her. She really did want to vote. She was alarmed by Trump.
Yeah, and the amazing thing about this is she was someone who, even though she lost her driver's license, she had a Wisconsin ID that was expired. She was registered to vote in Wisconsin. She had voted at her polling place in the primary, so the poll workers knew who she was. So she was qualified to vote. She was registered to vote, but she wasn't able to vote for the first time in her life, simply because she misplaced one piece of identification. And what was alarming to me is that she also said that her daughter and her nephew also didn't vote because they didn't have their IDs either. And so you have three people in one family alone that didn't vote because of this law. And, you know, we heard so much about a lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, but there were people that wanted to vote and were not able to. And I think that particular narrative needs a lot more attention because we hear all the time that people weren't motivated to vote, the Clinton campaign didn't campaign in Wisconsin, and those are all valid critiques. But the fact that people did want to vote, and in fact actually showed up and tried to vote and were unable to, is something that I think didn't get nearly enough attention. And this one woman, Andrea Anthony, told me that she felt like the right to vote was being stripped away from her. And if you look at the data in Milwaukee, turnout was down only slightly in white middle-class areas of the city, but it was down dramatically in more African-American, lower-income neighborhoods. And the head of elections in Milwaukee says that he believes that was in large part because of the voter ID law. And he believes that the voter ID law changed the election in the state of Wisconsin.
And again, I'm speaking with Ari Berman, who's a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And his latest book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And he has an article at Mother Jones, Rigged, How Voter Suppression Threw Wisconsin to Trump. So, as you know, Ari, Donald Trump is, in spite of some of the problems he has getting stuff through the Congress and his own mercurial and somewhat bizarre behavior, he's not getting a lot accomplished, but he's getting an awful lot accomplished in terms of filling the judiciary. And he has an unusually large number of vacancies there in federal courts, which he's filling at great speed with the help of the Federal Society. But he's putting in a lot of very reactionary judges. In fact, they just appointed or nominated a judge who has tremendous hostility to voting rights and is a great champion of voter suppression. So let's walk through the legal history of how Governor Walker of Wisconsin was able to get this law, because it was challenged initially, wasn't it?
Yes. And you remember, at the same time that Scott Walker was passing a very controversial law to dismantle protections for unions and collective bargaining for unions, they were also passing this voter ID law at the same time, which legislators in the state said they were passing, in their words, because of the neighborhoods around Milwaukee and college campuses across the state, with the basically implicitly saying that they were trying to disenfranchise African-American and student voters at the same time that they were trying to demobilize unions who were the key backers of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. So the law was blocked because the federal judge found that there were 300,000 registered voters that didn't have strict forms of ID, that African-Americans were twice as likely as whites not to have them, and that there wasn't a single case of voter impersonation in Wisconsin that the law would have prevented. But unfortunately, in 2014, it was reinstated by a panel of Republican-appointed judges, a very conservative panel of judges. And that just goes to show you that you can't rely on the courts to block these laws, because there are very, very conservative judges on there who, because of ideology, not facts, are putting these things in place. And now Trump is absolutely reshaping the judiciary so that more of these laws are going to be approved in the future, which makes it even more important to organize against them at the local level and also try to elect different people who will pass these kind of measures in the future.
Well, didn't one of the Republican representatives in the state of Wisconsin basically let the cat out of the bag, Representative Glenn Grothman, who basically said that Wisconsin had gone for Barack Obama by 7 points in 2012. I think Hillary Clinton's about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up, he told local TV. And now we have a photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well. Well, it maybe made a little bit of a difference, but it made enough of a difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why Wisconsin Republicans were so determined to defend this law in court is because they knew that it would make a big difference in close elections. They knew that Wisconsin had a history of very close elections. They were looking for any advantage they can get, and this was the same party, we should remember, that gerrymandered the maps to protect their own power, that tried to completely demobilize unions, who are the biggest backer of the Democratic Party. So the voter ID law and other changes by the Wisconsin legislature was just one of many attempts in the state to try to give a huge electoral advantage to the Republican Party.
And what can the Democrats do now? The evidence is the writing's on the wall. This voter suppression works. It's enabled through a stacked judiciary that's partisan. That happened in the state of Wisconsin, as you made clear, through Governor Scott Walker. Now it's happening at a national level with Donald Trump appointing reactionary judges to the federal courts. Could happen all the way across the state. We also have, on top of that, demographic changes, where more and more people are crowding into cities, where the blue state votes and the Democratic votes are being diluted, and the power goes to the rural counties. The Electoral College will come into play more and more. An estimate is in about 20, 30 years, 60% of the United States Senate
will be voted in with 40% of the population. So we've seen this gap from the last election where Hillary Clinton won 3 million more in the popular vote. These are the trends in the future. So there's a bunch of alarming trends. Do you sense there's a wake-up call going on with the Democrats?
Well, I think there needs to be. I mean, we're getting in a situation where the Republican Party has become a majority party through minority rule, through voter suppression, through gerrymandering, through all of the institutional things that you mentioned that help them and hurt Democrats. I mean, there's kind of two things you can do about it. You can kind of give up your hands and say, nothing's going to change and my vote doesn't matter, which would be exactly what they want. Or you could say, this is going to make me more motivated to try to vote, more motivated to try to help other people to vote, more motivated not just to try to challenge these laws in court, which groups have been doing, but also trying to organize against them and to make people who pass these laws pay more of a political price. And I think that's what needs to happen. And I think there also needs to be more of a focus on down ballot races, on state legislative races, on Secretary of State races, where a lot of these laws are being fought. Because while the Congress and the presidency is important, the fight over suppression is largely in the states, and that hasn't gotten nearly as much attention, particularly among Democratic voters.
Well, I've noticed on the political left that much of what the discussions about voting and voter suppression do reinforce despair. They're all about black box voting and conspiracies, and my sense is that at the end of the day, it feeds into that idea of despair that, oh, well, the game's rigged against you, there's no point in voting, which is, as you point out, is exactly what these voter suppressors want you to feel. I mean, what's your reading on the what's going on in terms of the debate on the political left?
Well, I hope that when people read my article and my writing, that's not what they take away from it. The reason why I've been writing so much about this is because I want people to recognize how much power their vote actually has. And the reason why people are trying to suppress votes is because they know that the vote has power. If anything, voter suppression is a recognition that your vote does matter, or else people wouldn't be going to such extraordinary lengths to try to prevent people from voting. And so I hope that it mobilizes people and it inspires them to get more involved and not demobilize them, because I think that's absolutely what the intention of these laws are.
Well, in case people haven't noticed, Donald Trump is president of the United States, and he's exercising enormous power and changing this country and its position and its role in the world. And even his own handlers can't handle him, and he gets his way, or gets most of his way, and does things that are completely even against the wishes of his closest aides, like the tearing up the Iran deal and killing Obamacare. So to my mind, the writing is so clear, it's so manifestly clear that elections have consequences, and we have a president who has enormous power.
Yeah. Yes, that absolutely should be.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Ari Berman.
Thank you so much, Ian. Bye.
Bye. And again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who's a senior reporter at Mother Jones, covering voting rights, and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And his latest book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And he also has an article at Mother Jones, Rigged, How Voter Suppression Threw Wisconsin to Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.